Quick math, beauties. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything just costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math and see how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Jillian. That's netsuite.com/Jillian. netsuite.com/Jillian.
When you need to refuel between meetings or running errands, or you just want a healthy snack that squashes your hunger, Wonderful Pistachios, which come in a variety of flavors and sizes, by the way, are the perfect choice to fill you up and keep you going throughout the day. Wonderful Pistachios is also a good source of protein and a zero guilt snack. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, guys, which gives you over 10% of your daily value. And with flavors like salt and pepper, sweet chili, and seasoned salt in the shelled variety, options like chili roasted, sea salt, and vinegar or jalapeno lime in the no shell variety, you're sure to please your taste buds while snacking healthy. So check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about how these little green wonders can power up your day. Hey guys, I know we're all working so hard to stay fit and healthy at home. So check out my app. I have free daily 7-minute workouts. Download the app. It's Jillian Michaels Fitness app. Download it. Do the 7-minute workouts. You don't need any equipment. There's total body workouts, ab workouts, leg workouts. You get a new one every single day. And if you want more, obviously, there's a heck of a lot more in the app. There's over 1,000 different exercises. All of my DVD workouts are in the app. I can customize a workout for you in the app. There's freaking yoga, kickboxing, HIIT training, outdoor runs, bodyweight training, free weights. There are thousands of recipes, no matter what your diet preferences are. But at the very least, please do the 7-minute workouts for free. This is such an easy way to start the show. A happy new year.
Yeah.
Like, legit.
We
right?
got
That's,
it.
I mean, we're just 2021. I didn't think we'd make it.
No.
So glad we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby. And I'm singing for everybody.
Yeah. That's...
You prefer Shania Twain, is what you're saying. We have a health psychologist on the show today to help us start this year out on the right foot. Her name is Kelly McGonigal. I've got to say, she is one of the most impressive individuals I have had the pleasure of speaking with in a very long time. This woman is a lecturer at Stanford. She's a best-selling author 3 times over. She's, of course, a TED Talker, and her TED Talk has over 20 million views on how to make stress your friend. And you might be wondering, what is a health psychologist? And it's going to blow your mind, actually. Her new book, The Joy of Movement, essentially explores why and how physical exercise is a powerful antidote to literally depression, anxiety, loneliness, redefining self-image, overcoming tragedy. And she doesn't approach any of this stuff in the way that I typically have, right? It's not actually about physical health. It's about mental and emotional well-being. This woman redefined the way I see fitness when I first heard her speak, and I think that says a hell of a lot, considering I've been doing this for 2 decades. And she's going to come on and talk to us right now, essentially about redefining stress so that it works for you instead of against you. And you might be thinking, like, yeah, I've heard that platitude before. No, I'm legit serious. The way we think about stress, or she's going to teach us to think about stress or hardship changes our biology, changes the effect that stress has on our actual brain chemistry. It's kind of amazing stuff, how to form deeper connections, how to literally see yourself in any way you choose to through the way you move your body. And I'm not even going to keep talking. I'm going to bring Kelly on to do the talking for me, because this is why she is one of the best in the world at what she does. It's going to be a great show, and I think the perfect way to help us feel, as Kelly says, energized hope as we move into 2021. So stick with us. We'll be right back. Building your wardrobe is a continuous journey of finding what makes you feel like you. And when I got my blue organic cotton waffle Henley from Everlane, it instantly became one of my staples because it's so comfortable. And one of the things I love about Everlane is that they do extensive research and vetting to use ethical factories that provide fair wages and reasonable hours to the skilled people who make their clothing. And that makes me feel really good about wearing Everlane. Plus, they share exactly how much their products cost to make, from labor to transportation. It's a new year, people, so why not treat yourself to a little something that not only feels good on, but you can feel good wearing. From denim to super soft loungewear, check out Everlane. Just go to everlane.com/Jill and sign up for 10% off your first order plus free shipping, and get easy returns within 60 days of your ship date. That's 10% off your first order when you go to everlane.com/Jill and sign up. Everlane.com/Jill.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Soup or salad? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From your online start to your first million orders, Shopify's there to help you grow. No matter what your product is, they can help you sell it everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, Shopify can help you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average than other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Jillian, all lowercase. Just go to shopify.com/Jillian now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Jillian.
All right, guys, we are back with health psychologist Kelly McGonigal. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
So, all right, I'm not even going to pretend that I'm not a fan. You know I'm a fan, which is why we reached out to you. And I wanted to talk a little bit, obviously, about your new book, The Joy of Movement, How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. You know, I'm completely on board with that one.
Yes.
But also about your TED Talk on stress. And it's been said about you that you have a, quote, groundbreaking way of seeing the world. I believe that was O Magazine who said that about you. And I like to ask every guest we have on the show a little bit about them. You know, what does that mean, right? Like, where do you think this way of seeing the world came from? Why did you get into this line of work? And I believe that, you know, as our guests tell us sort of their, I call it their origin story, not only does it bring context, but there's so much relatability there. And I know a little bit about your background, but not a lot. And I, by myself, am curious.
I know it's so, one of the reasons you don't is because talking about myself is like the one thing that makes me so nervous. I've been really working on this, trying to be braver, talk about myself and my experiences instead of just, you know, the studies or the science that lights me up. So, you know, the origin story, which means I don't have a great, like, perfectly crafted origin story because I'm still getting used to, like, telling it. But I think that...
But why does it light you up? I mean, that says it all. It lights you up. It is your passion. And I find that when people are living their passion, it's definitely rooted in something personal.
So the thing that I think that distinguishes me from a lot of people who became scientists is, so a lot of people who do science are driven by curiosity, intellectual curiosity, or they have like a specific problem they want to solve. And I'm driven by empathy. So if you were to go back and meet me as a child, the way that my family and teachers would have described me is like super empathic and highly sensitive, oversensitive. And one of the reasons that I became a psychologist and health psychologist is, you know, first of all, I just want to understand human experience and other people. I'm fascinated by what it means to be human. And then also,
Hold on. I can't let that go. I'm sorry. Hold on. I like to take notes along the way so I can circle back to things, but I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do that. In your opinion, what does it mean to be human then?
Yeah. So there are two things that I'm kind of obsessed with. One is how it is that people manage to get through and move forward from really difficult experiences. So part of, not to be like too dark or deep about it, but part of being human is suffering. And I have always been fascinated by how do people continue to find joy and hope and meaning, even in the midst of pain or loss or crisis. So that's part of, you know, what I think it means to be human. And then the other thing that really guides my way of thinking about how to help people is that human beings have these conflicting instincts. We're neither all good nor all bad. And so for any part of like your human nature, there's gonna be an instinct, say, to withdraw, and there's also an instinct of courage, and we have both of those. And so whether, you know, I'm trying to help people who are recovering from addiction, like have some more compassion for themselves about why it is so hard to resist a craving, and also that humans have this tremendous capacity to tolerate discomfort if they have a reason important enough to. So I feel like that's also, when I think about what it means to be human, I'm fascinated by these competing instincts. And a lot of my work is about how to help people make peace with that, that like you don't have to be perfect and you don't have to. So for example, I've always been an anxious person, and I know now I don't have to get rid of fear in order to be brave. I also, you know, part of my origin story is I grew up with chronic pain that's unexplained. And also, you know, people didn't believe me as a kid. So like my pain was both invisible and perceived as not real. And so one of the things that I learned growing up is, okay, you don't have to get rid of the pain in order to also experience pleasure or, you know, joy and connection. And so I feel like making room for opposites to exist is like the definition of what I'm trying to do.
You know, it's funny, for years in my own therapy, my therapist has taught me about this notion of splitting, right? Where it's like you make things all good or all bad, mm-hmm. and you can correct me here, you are the psychologist in the room. Because it's a way of avoiding pain, because if something's all good, right? You don't ever have to grieve anything. No one can, it's all good. So you're just blinded by the good. And if it's all bad, well, then there's no loss there because it was shit to begin with. And I know in my life, I've thrown the baby out with the bathwater before, right? And it's like, you've got to learn to tolerate both. Yeah. And I wonder why you think that is so unbearably difficult for us. And do you think that your own experience of having to have combined, like, okay, I'm living in pain and I'm feeling fear about it, and, you know, there's question about, this is another thing with my own daughter, whenever she's in pain, you know, my inclination was always be like, you're fine, and he's like, you're teaching her not to believe herself when you do that.
Yes.
You're compromising her confidence, and you need to validate her feelings. You can say she's okay, you can be like, I'm sorry that it hurts, honey. It's going to be okay, and then reassure her. And you not having that, did you have to learn to self-soothe, do you think? And that's where you've come up with the way forward on stress and redefining stress and redefining how we suffer in a way that helps us. I just asked you 50 things. I'm sorry.
Let's start with the big human question.
Right.
Why are we so thinking in terms of these absolutes, all good, all bad?
Yes.
You know, part of it, I think, is that it gives us a sense of control and hope. I mean, so, and this really gets to my work on stress. I think we have a deep-seated need to believe that there's a version of our lives that is available to us if we get it right, that is full of everything we want, the pleasure, the meaning, the growth, the relationships, and isn't stressful. Like, we just need to get just do it right. And so sometimes we go into that absolute thinking because it's really hard to just surrender to the idea that if your life is meaningful, it's going to be complex and it's going to hold pain and loss and confusion and outrage and all of that. And so I think part of it is just trying to hold on to that hope that if we will get to a place where because we figured out what is good or we've excised everything in us that is bad, that our life will be easier. And that it's just so human to want that, because if we didn't desire comfort and safety, you know, we wouldn't survive. So part of it is just a survival instinct. And so many of the instincts that I think we judge ourselves for are rooted in actually this amazing will to survive, which is something that actually is worth being proud of. I mean, there's so much, like I think about all the things, the problems that I'm drawn to better understand things like post-traumatic stress disorder and addiction and grief, anxiety disorders, that like they aren't evidence that you are uniquely broken. They are almost always, chronic pain is a good example of this too. They are evidence that your body and brain are working really, really hard to protect you and to learn from experience. And like that's part of, so I feel like that was part of the my experience with pain, with learning to make peace with that, like how hard my body and brain are working to try to be safe or to conserve energy. And that it's just, you know, the case that often with chronic pain or PTSD or addiction is we kind of overlearned things that aren't really helpful, but they were learned from an attempt to take care of us. And so if we can view our own suffering from that point of view, then it's easier to say, okay, well, what do I want to add to this? What do I, is there a way, a new way of thinking or acting or relating to my experiences that can create enough shift so that I feel more free, or that I feel less of whatever this struggle is?
You know, when I first saw you speak, and it was make stress your friend, I sort of had this assumption that you were being literal in that, like, oh, you know, you stress a bone and the bone remodels itself and becomes stronger. But it obviously was not that at all. It was about redefining the way you perceive suffering, pain, and stress. And that's really what you've done. And then you backed it up with all this empirical evidence about how you can change your biological response to stress by changing your mind about it.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean, it's kind of mind-bending, to be honest. And I was sort of hoping that you could elaborate on that, because I can tell, obviously, by the way you speak, how you know, and who you are, and knowing about you, that that's what you've done. You've redefined suffering and stress and all of these things. But can you sort of elaborate on what that actually means, and then subsequently what that actually does?
Yeah. And so first of all, I will say that the first idea that you mentioned, I actually do believe in the idea that we need stress in order to grow. So actually, like, that is part of how I think about stress, the idea that if we are never challenged, if we don't have to engage with life in ways that challenge us, that actually is, we can't thrive. So that idea that stress can make you stronger, that's part of how I think about stress. But the idea behind the TED Talk is really challenging this idea that most of us have heard, that stress is an inherently toxic state in your mind and body, and that every time you experience what we would label as stress, you have a fight, flight, or fright response. And that it's the same biological response. It's, you know, a whole bunch of cortisol and adrenaline and you know, high blood pressure and all these things, high inflammation, that are not healthy in the long run and really only serve you if you are fleeing a burning building or having to defend your life, you know, in a fight. And so there's this idea that our stress response is broken. It is kind of, it does not serve us to meet the modern challenges of life. This is the way that forever psychologists and physicians talked about stress. It's wrong. And so what I was trying to do with the TED Talk is start this conversation about why that idea is wrong, that your body has a stress response repertoire, and many of the ways that your brain and body can respond to stress are healthy and helpful and skillful, that they actually make your heart healthier, they make your immune system healthier, they can strengthen relationships, they can increase your sense of confidence. stress does not always turn you into the worst version of yourself and destroy your immune system and kill brain cells. It doesn't have to. Now, sometimes it does. And I just want to be really clear. I'm not, I don't know if you can tell, I'm not like an optimistic person. Like, you know, we talk about holding opposites. Yeah, there's forms of stress that are really bad for your health and not great for your brain and all of that. So I'm not here to say that, like, let's go out and suffer as much as possible and pretend that nothing will ever harm you. That's not how I think. But it is so fascinating to know that, let's say you're experiencing a moment that matters and you really want to bring your best self. Maybe it's a difficult conversation with a family member, or you're going into a business meeting that you need to negotiate, or you're an athlete competing. We know that there's a type of a stress response called a challenge response that gives you access to all of your resources, that helps you focus, that helps you perform under pressure, that makes you feel more confident, that helps you connect with others, that leads to objectively better outcomes, and it looks different than a fight or flight response. You have less inflammation, your blood vessels are less constricted, it's good for your heart health, it's good for your immune system, and it actually looks a lot like what happens in your body when you exercise. And it's still a stress response. And so in the TED Talk, I mentioned this one study. It's one of dozens of studies that have shown the same effect, that if you're having a fight or flight response, so let's say it's a moment that matters and you're starting to panic, where you feel, I'm more likely to freeze, so I'm more likely to get paralyzed in those moments. And maybe there is something happening in your body and brain that's not really helpful in this moment or not healthy. So these studies show that if in that moment you stop telling yourself there's something wrong with the fact that you're stressed, if you say, okay, this, I'm anxious because this is a moment that matters, it's okay that I care, my stress might actually be helping me. That's it. That's the whole reset. This is not like going to therapy for 10 years to convince yourself that stress is good for you. What I do is I say my heart is in it because I'm likely to maybe feel my heart pounding. So I say to myself, my heart is in it. It's okay that I'm stressed. And then I just focus on who and what I care about or what I want to accomplish. So studies show in that moment, you start changing things like how constricted your blood vessels are, what the ratio of stress hormones, what's happening in your brain, shifting into a state that allows you to be this best version of yourself. And that's just one example. And so, you know, in the TED Talk, I talk about a couple. In my book, I talk about a few more. But the idea is that there are these ways of thinking about stress that allow you to meet the moment with a stress response that really serves you. And a challenge response is one of them. You harness it by basically saying that you're up to the challenge and accepting that stress is energy you can harness, or it's a sign that you care and that your body and brain are trying to help you. But I know we're also gonna talk a little bit about the social stress response, which is really my favorite reframe.
Yeah, okay. So this really threw me because I don't fully understand it. And I watched it a couple of times, but you talked about how oxytocin is a stress hormone, but everything I've ever read is like a mom holds her newborn and they bond through the skin on skin and oxytocin is released and it's a mind meld and they're bonded forever. Or you have sex with somebody and you release oxytocin and you're bonded forever. But like, that's the last thing I ever associated with stress was oxytocin. I don't even understand how that's so counterintuitive to me. Like, I can't even process it.
Okay, so here's why it should be intuitive. Think about in moments of stress that are bigger than you. You can't just rise to the challenge and solve it yourself. Maybe you're not the only one who's struggling. And the best way to cope is to connect with others, to reach out, and maybe to team up with other people who are in the same situation, or to learn from people who've been through it, to surround yourself with the people who care about you, and also to like look for ways that you can contribute. Now, if we know that this is how humans survive, which of course it is, one of the ways that humans survive and thrive is we need one another. We need to be able to lean into interdependence. What would make more sense than if one of the stress hormones that your brain releases in moments of bigger than self-stress is this bonding hormone that it doesn't. So oxytocin is so fascinating because it doesn't only create social bonds, but one of the things it does is it calms down anxiety and fear. So it makes you feel less paralyzed. It helps you overcome that kind of despair we often feel in stressful moments that we can't control ourselves and just do it all by ourselves. Yes. So oxytocin helps us feel less despair. It activates the motivational system of the brain that makes us braver and more hopeful. It increases the sense that there is something we can do to actually improve the situation. I think of it as like a hope hormone. And it also increases the warm glow that we get from connecting with others. So if you're able to help someone, it's going to feel even better. It's going to feel better if somebody gives you a hug or helps you. I mean, one of the hardest things for a lot of people is to accept help. And so part of oxytocin as a stress hormone is to try to help you have the courage to even ask for help. So that's why, but actually, so let's talk about this more, but I want to just pull back one little bit and say, oxytocin is one of the stress hormones that people don't appreciate, but there are others too. And so the even bigger idea is, if I ask people to name stress hormones, people would probably say adrenaline, cortisol, which gives you energy, right, but can also make you feel amped up. And cortisol, whose primary job is actually to help you harness energy. That's really what it's doing in a typical stress response. But there's so many other hormones and brain chemicals that are released during stress. And to a degree, the ratio of those chemicals depends on your mindset. So not everyone releases oxytocin during moments of stress. If you have a really fixed mindset that says, I am alone, nobody cares about me, or I have to do it all myself, or like me, I don't want to be a burden, or like I don't want to feel vulnerable if people were to know that I was struggling, you can actually start to shut down because your brain was like, well, she's not going to do it anyways. So let's just give her, I'm talking about myself. So my brain might be like, we know she's not going to ask for help. So let's just give her a freeze response and she'll go hole up in her bedroom and be terrified and afraid. So we have to overcome some of those stress habits by really thinking about, you know, what kind of stress strengths would we like to develop? So one of the great things about, you know, talking about this type of research is you get better at your own stress habits. And so I've been really proud of myself for working on being more willing to reach out and have this kind of stress response. I'm sure I'm changing my biology as a result of it.
You're basically suggesting that you can change your body's involuntary, and I say involuntary because I would love to be like, listen, brain, I would love it if you could release more dopamine today or some serotonin. we don't consciously have any awareness that we can shift that. But you're basically saying that the way we think can affect our actual brain chemistry, for better or for worse.
And here's what's so important about this. I think we need to understand brain chemistry as preparing us to engage with life in certain ways. So would it be possible to take a drug that increases dopamine? Yeah, you can. People with Parkinson's disease will take it. But if you know that dopamine as a brain chemical is there to embolden action, because it's related to movement, to increase positive motivation, to help you focus, you have a better chance of increasing dopamine in your brain if you're not going to take, you know, pharmaceuticals for it, by figuring out what it is you really care about, or listening to music, which is like the leading invitation to move. Yes. Like there's no better way to convince your body and brain that it's time to engage with life than to listen to music. And then you get the side effect, which is you've got more dopamine in your brain, and then it's easier to focus or feel motivated. So I feel like sometimes people think, well, if I could just, why don't I just inhale oxytocin? You can buy oxytocin.
You can?
In an inhalant. Yes, you can, but you don't need to. And I think that actually it's almost, so I like to talk about specific brain chemicals or hormones because it's interesting and it feels really concrete. But it's not only oxytocin that encourages us to reach out to others or that makes our stress response healthier. And like, we haven't talked yet about oxytocin is like good for your heart and good for your immune system and all of that. But oxytocin is like, it's something you can measure that demonstrates that your body and brain are trying to help you deal with a stressful experience, in part by reaching out to others and in part by not giving up hope. But the oxytocin is just one bit of that. And it's a whole bunch of other stuff too, like dopamine and vasopressin and nitric oxide to protect your heart and all this other, DHEA to help your brain learn from the experience. There's a lot going on. And if you start with the mindset, what you're doing is it's almost like a really complex placebo effect. The mindset that says, you know, this is a moment that matters. It's bigger than me. So I'm going to choose to respond to this stress by reaching out to others. Like literally that, what I just said, if you can just pause, take a breath and think it, your brain is built to respond to your perceptions of the world. That's all stress is anyway. The most stress is just your perception. It's often accurate that something is at stake, right? Or something is changing and you need to respond. It's a perception that puts into motion all of these processes in your brain and body to help you respond. So I'm like a really big fan of just going to the root of it. Of course, it's because I'm a psychologist. Maybe if I were a physician, I'd want to just prescribe an oxytocin inhalant. But I think like people shouldn't be surprised that mindset can be as effective as like snorting a molecule, because what do you think your brain is doing anyways? It's
well, from a fitness perspective, it's, you know, I always get so many young kids. I have a 30-year-old brother and all his friends are like these young guys. And this is going to seem sort of off piece, but they see these guys on Instagram that are all jacked up, right? And they want to go and take something because it seems like it works. I mean, it's worked for this guy and he's got all the girls and he's living his best life. And it's crazy the way that they think this works. And I have to explain to them, I'm like, listen, when you take this stuff exogenously, instead of making it endogenously, allowing your body to make it and regulate it and know how to utilize it, you're creating a host of problems. Now, I understand that they're psychiatrists and this is their business. And, you know, if somebody needs antidepressants, like I have zero judgment. But mm-hmm. jumping into controlling your thoughts, right, to get your brain to do its job and shift that biochemistry in a positive way, what are your definable go-tos to do that?
So before I say that, I just want to thank you, Jillian, for mentioning, sometimes when I talk about this stuff, people mistakenly think what I'm saying is, so nobody ever needs to take an antidepressant medication, or you never need, like, I am a scientist, I'm in favor of everything that works and every single thing that is effective self-care for you. So I actually, that, thank you for saying that, because I don't want someone to listen and think that what I'm saying is, if you're depressed, listen to music, don't go see therapist. But
everything you're saying is exactly, though, we do want to be proactive in the best possible way, if then you hit a wall. Like, I almost look at it personally.
It's a yes and. It's not an either or.
Right.
When antidepressants work, one of the ways they seem to work is by making the brain more plastic to learning. And actually by making it easier to take new mindsets and to learn from positive experiences. A lot of psychological suffering comes because the brain has learned from traumatic experiences or negative experiences in a way that increases depression or anxiety. And so, you know, part of the way that a lot of medications work is making it easier to be changed by new experiences. So they can often work together really well. Exercise, by the way, does the same thing. But wait, so you asked for action steps, and I don't want to be like ignore that. So here's the first one. You have to be willing to feel the emotions that your body and brain produce to nudge you towards the most helpful coping strategies. So a lot of times people feel overwhelmed in moments of stress because they are not meant to handle it on their own. And so many of us hate the feeling of being overwhelmed, and we don't yet have a roadmap. What does it mean to ask for help, or to learn from other people's experiences, or to make this about something bigger than myself? So instead, we look for a way to stop feeling overwhelmed. And then that's when you can run into unhealthy coping strategies. Some people get drunk, some people clean their closet. There's nothing wrong with cleaning your closet, but if you're just doing it to not feel overwhelmed, you have to sometimes feel the emotions and to start to read stress emotions as signals about where the potential is to cope well. So loneliness is another really good example.
Yes.
I keep trying to explain to people that loneliness is like being hungry. And it doesn't mean that people don't care about you and you are alone. When you feel alone, it's like being hungry and your brain is saying, go be with people. People care. You're feeling a hunger for connection. And when you're feeling hungry, you're not like, oh, I guess there's no food. No, you're like, where's the food?
So I
feel like
you're absolutely right.
Sometimes it's the emotions that are most difficult for us that, and I've actually, so one of the ones that I've had to learn to reread is fear, because it's one of my first stress emotions. And then fear can lead me to want to withdraw and say, like, I'm not here for this anymore, whether it's mentally or literally physically, I'm out the door. And so I had to start reading fear, first of all, as I mentioned before, it's like a sign that I care. And that's absolutely true. I know that now. I feel fear when I care about something. So to learn to read that as the first signal so that I can actually stop myself and say, am I willing to tolerate this fear in the service of something that matters to me? And now the answer to that is much more likely to be yes, because I've stopped making my first goal to not have to feel
afraid. Right.
Which would often lead to avoidant coping strategies.
Yes, right.
Another practical thing is to ask yourself, who or what do you care about most in this moment? Because, so the way that I define stress is it's what arises when something that you care about is at stake. Now, sometimes we have these bad stress habits where we have these like huge fight or flight responses to things that don't matter. And if you start asking yourself, who and what do I care about most in this moment? If it's a big overreaction, sometimes even just asking yourself that allows you to just let it go. But for most people, when they're really stressed, it's because they do care. It's about, you know, the health of their loved one or uncertainty around money and work and yes. all the, you know, things that in the world that they want to change and they don't know how to change it. So we care. And when you ask yourself who or what you care about most and then what can you choose in this moment that honors that or that reflects it, that gets you closer to that. Because again, one of the most destructive forms of coping is avoidant coping, in which all you do is try to feel less stressed. And you know, most people do not get to choose how much stress is in their lives. And if you just try to feel less stress, often people pull back from the things where you really could find joy and meaning and purpose and growth, but you can't pull back from the stuff that is just awful and sucks and you have no control over. And so you end up with this kind of imbalance almost of like, you can't control the really bad stress, but you're practicing all these strategies of not engaging with life that might give you more hope or connection or joy. And so like a third practical strategy is to think of joy as fuel for stress and for healthy engagement with stressful situations. This is something I've been really doubling down on during you know, this whole last year that's been so challenging, and talking to people all over the world about what has helped them get through this past year. And for so many people, it is about prioritizing things that fill you with joy, that it's not only the classic kind of self-care you hear about, like go calm down. A lot of us right now, what we need is fuel. We don't need to be more relaxed. We need that kind of energized hope that comes when you've done something that just fills you up. So I think of that. And you know, I first really learned that working with both people who were doing protest work and also physicians who work in palliative care with children and are constantly dealing with families who are grieving and children who are in pain. So you've got people, like two groups of people, right, who are out there engaging with suffering that is hard and it is meaningful. And to just like go home and try to relax, it almost doesn't meet the moment. You need more than a deep breath. What you need is that kind of positive life force that comes because you were able to dance, you know, that like have a dance protest at the protest, or you were able to, you know, you've rescued a dog and you're able to spend time with the dog. I don't know what it is that fills you up with joy, but to think of that as a practical coping strategy and not an indulgence.
God, I love that. I love that energized hope. That is so succinct and perfect. Kelly, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk all about your new book, The Joy of Movement, how exercise helps us find happiness, hope, connection, and courage, because it's fantastic. So stick with us, guys. We'll be right back with Kelly McGonigal. You guys know that I always want you to be your healthiest selves, right? Well, FitTrack actually makes a scale that measures health, not just weight. And I've been checking it out and it's pretty cool. The Dara Smart Scale measures 17 vital health metrics, including BMI, hydration levels, and muscle mass. And it syncs with the free FitTrack app, so all your personalized insights are saved in one place. That way, I personally can get a clear picture of my overall health. And proper hydration is always a struggle for me, so that's been one of my favorite features. I try to use the scale every day and track it with the FitTrack app. So stop measuring weight and start measuring health with FitTrack. Go to fittrack.com/Jillian to take
50% off your order. Plus, for a limited time, you'll also save an additional 10%. That's FITTRACK.com/Jillian to save 50% plus get an additional 10% off your order. Don't miss out on this amazing limited time offer at FitTrack.com/Jillian.
All right, everyone knows by now how much I love Skims underwear because I mentioned them a ton and I've been wearing them forever. I mean, I guess specifically a year and change. That's like forever in my life. If I can stick with something for longer than 30 days, it's forever. So this is big for me. And let me tell you, they are worth the hype. From the support they give to their amazing shape, and best of all, they're super comfortable. Whether it's the weightless scoop bra, the fits everybody plunge bra, the fits everybody t-shirt bra, I just get them in sand. You don't see them under anything at all. They're awesome. They're comfortable. I don't even realize I'm wearing them. They go with everything. So shop Skims bras at skims.com now, available in 62 sizes from 38 to 46H. And if you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. So after you place your order, select podcast in the survey and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows.
Okay, who's tired of fasting or cleanses that just leave you hungry and exhausted instead of rejuvenated and energized? Well, Prolon is the scientifically proven meal plan solution you've been waiting for. Prolon is a revolutionary plant-based nutrition program that nourishes the body while making the cells believe they're fasting. Researched and developed for decades at the University of Southern California Longevity Institute and backed by leading U.S. medical centers, Prolon helps promote healthy blood sugar, support cardiovascular health, and reduce abdominal fat. But Prolon isn't a diet. Prolon is science. Science based on Nobel Prize-winning discoveries in medicine. And this all starts with Prolon's five-day program, snacks, soups, and beverages, all designed to keep your body in a fasting state. It's unlike anything you've ever experienced. I did it for 5 days because I've had the absolute hardest time with straight fasts for even 24 hours, and it was a game changer for me. So right now, Prolon is offering Keeping It Real Conversations with Jillian Michaels listeners 10% off their 5-day nutrition program. Just go to prolonlife.com/Jillian. That's prolonlife.com/Jillian for this special offer. That's prolonlife.com/Jillian.
Quick math, beauties. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything just costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math and see how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Jillian. That's netsuite.com/Jillian. netsuite.com/Jillian.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
All right, team, we are back with health psychologist Kelly McGonigal, and we are talking about your new book, The Joy of Movement, How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. Now, I actually know this about you, but I'm assuming most people don't, that you've been teaching fitness in your spare time for 2 decades.
Yes. I started teaching dance and yoga when I was a graduate student in psychology, and it is the absolute greatest joy in my professional life. I believe it is the most meaningful contribution I will ever make is leading group movement experiences. And I am so grateful that I convinced my publisher to let me write this book, because every other book I've written was, you know, people seeing what I was doing and being like, oh, you should write a book about that. You know, helping people with chronic pain, write a book about that. Class I was teaching on willpower, write a book about that. The TED Talk, write a book about that. Yeah. And finally I was like, you know what? I want to write a book about the thing that brings me the most joy and that I think is just the most important thing I can share with the world. That human beings, when we move our bodies in whatever way we can, in whatever body you have, so movement, not the movement that I'm interested in is not to actually transform your body, but to give you access to human joys that are particularly well activated by engaging with life through your body. And so like every chapter in the book is about one of these core human joys, like collective joy or persistence, that we can harness it by engaging in physical activities that give us access to that part of what it means to be human.
That is something I was actually going to bring up, is that you don't really address any of the, quote, physical benefits of it. It's not about, like, oh, you know, get a six-pack, not even remotely.
Yeah, it's not even about, like, avoid, you know, a heart attack or cancer. I mean, yes, of course. Exercise is, like, the best thing you can do for your physical health. What I think people don't understand are things like every time you elevate your heart rate and use your muscles, that your muscles release chemicals that function as antidepressants. Your muscles literally manufacture and release them. They travel through your bloodstream to your brain, and they can be as powerful as the most advanced treatments for depression or grief or addiction. That, like, I don't think people understand that. I know people understand it's, you know, it's good for your physical health. So that's what I want to share, is that, and again, that also the thing that's so great about it is, yeah, if you want to get a six pack, you probably have to do a certain type of exercise. But if you want hope and you want access to these hope molecules, all you have to do is move whatever parts of your body still move. Like, it's not about looking a certain way. It's not about not having certain disabilities or movement challenges. It's about finding the movement you can do and hopefully movement you enjoy or that has meaning.
You utilize fitness as a tool, but you are tackling things like self-image, surviving a horrendous loss and trauma, improving your social connections. I mean, I could go on, but I was wondering if you could sort of elaborate, because I think there's, I know it because I lived it, right? Like that is my kind of origin story, as I was like the fat kid, the kid that was picked on, the kid that had no self-esteem. My parents were going through chaos, and it's like, you know, it empowered me, and it did redefine the way that I saw myself in the world and what I believed myself capable of. But I don't have the ability to explain that like you do. I'm not a psychologist. Let's just pick self-image, for example, because the how-to, right, of like, how do I believe in my ability? How do I love myself more? How do I stop picking myself apart? It's great to say love yourself, but people don't have a clue. They don't have a clue.
Yes. Okay. So self-image. So part of this, this is going to sound like a little bit of a scientific diversion, but I think this is worth thinking about. So there's something called proprioception, which is your body's ability to sense itself. So, you know, if you were to like reach across the screen and move my arm into a position and I couldn't see it and I had my eyes closed, I could tell you what position my arm was in because my brain knows how to sense my body. So we know that proprioception is part of how your brain understands who you are, not only where you are in space or what action you're taking. And we know that movements have emotional qualities and psychological qualities. So let's say if I were to show you how to move your arm with grace, we're in a ballet class, and I teach you a port-a-bras, and you're moving your arm with a certain fluidity, and it's traveling through space in a certain way, you don't need to look in the mirror and say, oh, I'm beautiful. You don't need a teacher to say, oh, you're so graceful. Your brain will understand through the fluidity of your movement, the extension of your fingertips. It won't just think, my arm is moving gracefully. Your brain thinks, I am graceful. I am beautiful. So when you're doing something like a deadlift and you have to brace your core, and you lift something heavier than you ever thought you could lift, your brain gets all of these signals from the stabilization of your trunk, from the resistance on your tendons. These are signals that are sent to your brain that say, I am strong, I am capable. And so every movement has its own signal like that. One of the reasons why I, during this whole, like 2020, I have been doing a lot of boxing, because I need the feedback that comes from punching and kicking a heavy bag. And literally the feedback that I get when I slam my shin into the bag is not, you know, ow, that hurts. The signal that I'm getting is I have a will to survive and I will fight, which is not this is something I need to feel about myself, but I don't get that in other situations. And so I can sense myself as brave and a warrior and a fighter because my body knows it's true. So that's one way that movement can affect self-image. And I'm always encouraging people to find forms of movement that really represent a quality in themselves that they want to cultivate or develop, or that they feel is not valued by others. You know, maybe other people don't want you to be loud or strong or take up space. Maybe other people tell you you can't move in that sexual or sensual way, but to find a form of movement where you can and you honor that part of yourself. And here's what's great about, I know I could go on forever.
Here's what's so interesting to me is that if you'd asked me, I'm now starting to comprehend this in a way that I never have in this moment, which is kind of strange because I've been doing this for such a long time. I thought I knew everything about what I do. But as a kid, I was like, well, you know, it empowers people. You're empowered, you know. Now I'm the kid that broke two boards. And that makes me strong. But I never realized that it was about so much more than just the accomplishment, that it was literally physiological until you just told me in this moment.
Yeah, actually. And it is literally how your brain knows who you are. I mean, there's all these interesting neurological case studies of people who lose proprioception. And they don't just say, where's my arm? They say, I don't know who I am. I don't exist. We are such embodied people. And but the other thing I wanted to say about how movement can really help with self-image is one of the reasons why I'm passionate about group movement experiences is that other people see in you the quality of the movement as well.
Oh my God.
So if I were to go to a boxing class, other people see me as a fighter. When I lead a dance class, you know, I have all of my, I'm finally teaching outdoor dance classes again, and I see my women move so beautifully and with joy and being expressive. They're not, it's different than doing it alone in your living room, because we are all seeing it in you and celebrating it in you and witnessing it in you. It's why I think that, you know, exploring different forms of movement is so important for young people to as a, you know, a way of self-discovery, but also why it can be transformative at different times in your life, to have that kind of mirror put on you, where you are seen for the part of yourself that you really are working to develop or that you value.
Can you speak to me a little bit about the ways in which you feel it helps us overcome tragedy? Because mostly, you know, somebody goes through something awful, they're not getting off the couch, let alone thinking like, okay, if I get up and I go for a jog or I go for that hike or I move my body, it's going to help. They're like, fuck that. It's the last thing they're going to do, which is ironic.
I've been there. So one of the things I like to do is actually explain, first of all, why that is the case, because for two reasons. You know, I said in the beginning, I'm driven by empathy.
Yes.
So if you are in that situation, I want you to have empathy for yourself. And also, if you are the person who is trying to motivate someone, you need to understand what they're dealing with. I say this all the time, like, it just is a little bit off topic, but with something like addiction, and people are like, oh, they don't have any willpower. I'm like, have you ever been addicted to anything? 1 second of resisting is more willpower than somebody who has never been addicted to something will ever have to dig into and experience. The amount of strength that it takes to get through a day is inconceivable to people who have never experienced addiction. So the same is true with things like grief or depression or trauma. If you don't know what it's like with all of those things, grief, depression, trauma, part of what happens in your brain, for whatever the reason, whether it was caused by life experience or genetics, whatever is the trigger for it, part of what happens is your brain immobilizes you. All of them, sort of a core feature, is your brain slows you down physically. It makes it harder to physically move. Part of that is changes in the dopamine system. it makes it harder to imagine that you will experience positive emotions or pleasure. It makes it harder to actually experience positive emotions and pleasure. It is, and I in a way, having been through this myself, it's like you think your body and brain are absolutely betraying you. It's so cruel. And so here's what that's the empathy for, you need to understand what's going on. Right. So if somebody is grieving, it is physically hard to get off the couch. This is not being lazy or not having a negative mindset. Part of it is your body and brain are, in a sense, really inhibiting engaging with life. I've been there, so I know what it's like. And even as somebody who had found great joy and pleasure in exercise, to be like in a moment of grief where you go and you try and you can't even get through 3 minutes of exercise, and it's like everything in your body is like, just stop, just quit, what's the point? So what we know and why this helps is that exercise seems to be one of the only things that helps the brain recover from that, the way that the reward system gets impaired and inhibited by grief, depression, trauma, and addiction, that there's something about movement, even when initially it's the last thing in the world that you want to do, even when it does not give you an endorphin rush, that is teaching your brain to start to produce more dopamine, wow, more endorphins, more endocannabinoids, which is what cannabis mimics.
Yes.
All these chemicals in the brain that are associated with happiness, hope, connection, courage. It takes, so some of the studies suggest it takes like at least 6 weeks for these changes to be reflected in the structure of your brain, like how many receptors for dopamine or endogenous endorphins that you have available in your brain so that you can be sensitive to joy and pleasure, or so that you can start to feel hopeful. So your brain is changed through movement in the same way that your muscles are transformed, or the way that the structure of your heart is transformed, the way that your blood vessels change when you exercise. The same thing is happening in your brain. And just like in your body, it takes time. So there is hope. And again, that it's incredible that that the body and the brain have this capacity. So how do you get from the point where you feel like you can't do it?
That's what I was going to say, is with the part where you're like, you just can't, is it just, quote, Nike, just do it, just take that first step and it begets itself, or?
Yeah, sort of. So you, first of all, you start where you are and you do what you can. Okay. You ask for help. If there are people who will help you, you lower your expectations for what's possible and how it's going to feel. And then you bring in anything that is still giving you any sense of pleasure or hope. For a lot of people, and again, I'm not saying that this is always immediate or easy, but for a lot of people, it's music. For a lot of people, it's nature, being outdoors. There's a story that I write in the book about a woman whose son died, and she went into a very, very deep depression, and literally, like, she didn't want to live.
Yeah.
And her husband got her a Fitbit for Christmas, and she started out. Like, her initial state was, it's too hard to go upstairs to go to the bathroom, so I won't. Like, to have to climb, you know, like, that's the starting point.
Yeah.
And she built up to, you know, walking on the treadmill for a couple of minutes, to doing these, like, step challenges with her Fitbit, to walking the dog, to joining a running group, to eventually this thing that is the other side of it. So part of it is your brain will catch up. But the other thing is, sometimes you just find the thing that is healing beyond brain chemistry. And so the story, she joined a running group. They were running outdoors. And what she realized was, when she was running outdoors, she started to see and feel her son in a way that never happened in any other moment. And she, you know, she says things like, other parents say that, like, their children visit them in dreams, and that doesn't happen for me. But she felt her son when she was going for runs outdoors. And, you know, I don't mean to exploit this woman's tragedy by sharing her story. She was so generous in sharing the story for the book. I hope people will read it. But the thing that I love about that story is, like, yes, you know what? When you're out in nature, you can connect to something bigger than yourself.
Yes.
And that's real. It's not just about messing with your brain chemistry. I believe that there are movement experiences that are so powerful in and of themselves that they give us what we need. And so part of it is, again, it's more than exercise and mechanics. It's about asking yourself, can you imagine an experience that would be healing? And for me, the movement experience that has always been most healing for me is actually dancing in community. That's why I teach dance classes. But during COVID, when so many of my, I teach in a community center where a lot of women are older, many of them are widowed, live alone. And, you know, many of them have been telling me that the videos, the dance videos that I've been making for them is the only time that they've smiled in months, because they have a memory of what it feels like to dance in community. And this, even though we're apart, they have that sense of collective joy that comes from dancing in community. And so, you know, for me, I hope to be dancing as long as any part of my body still moves.
Kelly, you obviously have dedicated your life to this. I can see now why O Magazine said you have a groundbreaking way of seeing the world. For you to redefine the way I see exercise, considering, not to toot my own horn, but I am who I am and I've been doing it as long as I have been, is kind of a miracle, quite honestly, unto itself. Is there anything you learned in writing this book that redefined the way you looked at it?
I think that, you know, this was something that was really big for me, is coming to value intensity in a way that I did not before. That is physical intensity, doing things that are harder than you want to do and are beyond your comfort zone. And what I found in you know, visiting all these movement communities, whether, you know, I'm not talking about having to be a professional athlete. I'm talking about people at all levels of physical abilities, dealing, you know, stroke survivors, dealing with neurological disorders that make movement difficult, even in hospice care. At the end of life, when you've basically given up any expectation that you are going to be able to fix your body, that there was something about doing something harder than you want to do that is especially helpful at every level, whether it's the narrative that you're able to tell yourself about, I'm someone who can push through this feeling that says it's time to quit. You know, interviewing this man who uses ultra endurance running as like a metaphor for his depression. Wow. And learning that you, wow, can take one step forward more when every cell in your body is saying it's the time to give up, to looking at the biochemistry of what happens when you work a little bit harder outside your comfort zone and how much that increases things like the positive changes in your brain chemistry or the molecules that your muscles release that support psychological resilience. That I was somebody who didn't want to have to like commit to that idea, because part of me wants to just encourage people to just do whatever. Like, do anything, lie down, do snow angels on the ground. And so part of what was really, it's been really interesting to me is it's the two things that came across over and over, every community I visited, every story that I was talking to, it was about finding community. People were not doing stuff on their own. The people who would say movement changed my life, they had found some kind of community, whether it was a gym or a class or a running group. They weren't on their own, and that movement was helping them connect with others. That was part of it. I already knew that. I believed that. But this other thing, this intensity. And so it motivated me to push myself more. And so I love that aspect of writing the book. It allowed me to have a different experience of challenging myself. And I really feel the benefits of that.
So not all of us can be a student at Stanford taking your classes, obviously. But the best way to learn more about what you do is, guys, get the book, The Joy of Movement, How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. I mean, for it to be groundbreaking for me, I imagine it's probably going to be an incredible tool for pretty much anyone who reads it to change their life for the better, emotionally, as much as physically, emotionally and psychologically. And Kelly, where else can people go? KellyMcGonigal.com?
Yeah, that's it. And if people want to reach out to me, I do read all my DMs on Instagram.
Oh my God, so do you really? You savage.
Well, I don't get as many as you. Right now it's tolerable. People don't know I'm on Instagram.
You've opened Pandora's box now. Okay, if for some reason Kelly does not respond to your DM, she is a very, very busy woman. author, teacher, researcher, psychologist. So I'm just putting that out there that she wears many hats. So Kelly, I am so grateful for your time. Thank you so much for doing what you do and being who you are and sharing all of this information with us. You're truly an inspiration in every sense of the word.
Thank you. Thank you for this conversation.
All right, guys, we want you to subscribe to the podcast so you can stay up to date with our life-changing and life-saving information. So on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you're listening, click that subscribe button.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.